Welcome to the Deep Dive, specifically crafted for you. Today, we're embarking on an in-depth exploration of a really provocative and, well, detailed article. It's titled, A Harlot Rides a Beast with 10 Horns, by Dr. Gavin Finley from endtimepilgrim.org.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this piece offers a very, very particular interpretation of end-time prophecies, you know, from the books of Revelation and Daniel.
It really does.
And just to be clear, our mission today isn't really to debate the theology itself. It's more about thoroughly unpacking this specific interpretation. We want to understand its intricate claims, the vivid imagery it uses, and the historical parallels it draws.
Yeah, think of it like looking through a specific lens, the one the author provides, to view global power, spherical compromise, and a prophetic timeline.
Exactly. We'll be dissecting the core elements of this vision as the article presents them. You've got the enigmatic harlot, the powerful beast she rides, and this dramatic timeline where it all supposedly unfolds.
And what's really fascinating, I think, is the sheer specificity, how the article connects these, you know, ancient texts to very modern concepts like a new world order, and even pinpoints historical events. It offers this unique framework for seeing the future, at least as the author sees it.
Right. So if you're ready to dive into a compelling and, let's face it, deeply interpreted perspective on biblical prophecy, let's unlock the layers of this vision together.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start by really digging into this astounding vision. The one John the Beloved recounts, you know, while imprisoned on Patmos. It's in Revelation chapter 17. And the article right away highlights John's reaction. He's not just surprised, he's profoundly amazed, utterly flabbergasted, it seems to be the sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, the vision kicks off with an angel showing John the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. And she's not just there, she's actively seen riding a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads and 10 horns. I mean, that's a powerful image right there.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the description of the harlot herself, it's incredibly vivid, almost unsettling. Clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, holding this gold cup full of abominations.
Mm-hmm. And the unclean things of her immorality.
Right. But here's where the article says it gets really foundational for its whole interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
On her forehead, there's this inscription, a mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth.
Yeah, not just a nameplate. It's presented as her core identity, revealing her, you know, true nature and origin according to this view.
And what's also crucial is John's reaction to all this. He sees the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus.
And that image, understandably, deeply disturbs him. It causes him to wonder greatly, which prompts the angel to basically say, why are you amazed? I'll explain the mystery of the woman and the beast.
Okay, so the angel's explanation is positioned as the key to unlocking the whole narrative.
That's how the article frames it, yes.
So following this interpretation, the harlot figure is clearly riding or like exercising some kind of sovereignty over this 10-horned global beast. And the author is very specific about the timing, isn't he? Within the bigger end time picture.
That's a crucial point they make. This Revelation 17 vision is placed in an earlier time frame compared to other prophetic glimpses of the beast. The key detail they zero in on is that in this vision, the 10 horns on the beast did not have crowns or diadems.
No crowns.
Right. And they had not yet received a kingdom, which signifies, according to the author, that these 10 entities, whatever they are, they lack their own independent sovereign power at this specific moment. They exist, but they aren't fully in charge yet.
Okay, so because those horns are uncrowned, the harlot is the one exercising sovereignty over them. And the article interprets this whole scene as a picture of the New World Order as it opens up in the first 3.5 years of the 70th week.
Exactly.
Now, for listeners maybe not familiar with that term, 70th week, what does that signify here?
Good question. When the article talks about the 70th week of Daniel's prophecy, it's pointing to a very specific climactic 7-year period. In this interpretation, it's the final 7 years right before the return of Messiah.
Okay.
And that 7 years is seen as split into two halves, 3.5 years each. And the harlot's reign from Revelation 17 is specifically placed in that first half, setting the stage, basically.
Got it. That clarifies the timeline they're working with. So this 10-horned beast itself, what other prophecies does the article connect it to?
Well, it's directly linked in the article's view to the fourth beast of Daniel 7. And it also corresponds to the 10 toes of the statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream back in Daniel chapter 2.
Ah, all right.
So both Daniel and John in this reading are describing the same thing, this emerging global political entity that will persecute the saints. The author really emphasizes these aren't separate prophecies, but interconnected visions of the same power structure.
And the number 10, the 10 horns, 10 toes, that's hugely significant that it marks a real turning point.
Precisely. Yeah, Daniel 2 states that it's in the days of these kings, represented by the 10 horns or toes, that the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed.
The smiting stone.
Exactly, the stone hitting the statue's feet. The article links this to an epic, climactic, conclusive, apocalyptic, end-time event, one that completely ends Gentile or human-led world rule. So paradoxically, the rise of these 10 powers is actually the signpost for the beginning of the end of that whole system.
Which brings us to the million-dollar question, really. Who or what does the article say this harlot is? It gives a very specific and, I'd say, quite provocative identity.
It does. The harlot is identified quite pointedly as a debauched Bible prophecy denying Western Christendom, along with a compromised Holy Land selling Israel.
Wow. Okay, let's break that down. Bible prophecy denying suggests what? A religious system that just ignores or maybe misinterprets key prophetic warnings?
That seems to be the implication, yes. And compromised Holy Land selling Israel sounds like a segment of Israel that's perhaps made deals or concessions with global powers, maybe compromising its divine mandate or giving up some sovereignty, as the article puts it.
So it's not purely secular. It's a kind of religious and political mix in this view.
Exactly. A hybrid, deeply intertwined with that ten-toed beast, the end-time New World Order system we talked about.
The article even draws this parallel to Beauty and the Beast, calling it truly prophetic, but quickly adds, you know, this is not just a Disney story.
Right.
He talks about many from God's covenant people, both Western Christendom and Israel, making a sovereignty-sharing treaty with a global mega-dealer. And it explicitly links this to the Daniel 9.27 treaty. What's the significance of that treaty in this context?
Okay. The Daniel 9.27 treaty is seen as pivotal here. It's often interpreted as a covenant, a seven-year deal that the Antichrist figure, acting initially as a kind of peace broker, confirms with many. The article views this as a national sovereignty handover. Basically, a peace treaty that seems utopian on the surface, but actually leads to a mass apostasy, like it says in 2 Thessalonians 2.3, meaning many who claim to be God's people will, out of fear maybe, go over to another, even a false messiah. It's seen as this foundational compromise.
And the harlot isn't just swept along. She has her own agenda, right? The article says her agenda is the same as it always has been since Semiramis in ancient Babylon, all about her own usurpation of world power. Can you unpack that Semiramis connection a bit?
Sure. Semiramis is this, well, somewhat legendary queen from ancient Assyria and Babylon. She's often linked in some traditions with the origins of idolatry, pagan worship systems focused on, you know, human power and self-glory.
Okay.
So by connecting the harlot to Semiramis, the article is basically arguing this figure embodies an ancient spirit of rebellion against God's authority,
right,
driven by an insatiable lust for power, a desire to usurp the throne.
So it's this deep-seated drive for control, almost a spiritual ambition. The article even uses the term Jezebel to describe her spirit.
It does. Jezebel is used there as a kind of spiritual archetype, characterized by rebellion, that relentless power drive, and usurping the throne using the devices of witchcraft.
And it defines witchcraft here not as spells, but as
as domination, intimidation, and manipulation. Basically, any rebellion against God's legitimate authority is the sin of witchcraft, citing 1 Samuel. So the harlot church, in this view, promotes things like kingdom now or dominion theology.
Right. Movements focused on the church establishing God's kingdom on earth through like political or social action.
Exactly. Essentially trying to rule before Messiah returns. The article frames this as another human-driven power grab, trying to jump the gun on God's timing and methods.
That's quite an interpretation,
sure,
suggesting even religious efforts can fall into this trap of human-centered control, which leads to this really stark comparison the article makes. It labels harlot Christianity as religious humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And then it asks, pretty bluntly, is this any better than the secular humanism we've seen in history?
Mm-hmm.
What's the argument there?
The core argument seems to be that both religious humanism, like the harlot represents, and secular humanism ultimately share the same basic flaw. They rely on human effort, human reason, human power to build a perfect world instead of, you know, relying on God.
Okay.
And to back this up, the author presents this string of really tragic historical failures attributed to secular humanism.
It's a bleak list. It starts with the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Based on human reason, deism, but ending in the reign of terror, collapse, Napoleon.
Yeah.
Basically disaster.
Yeah. Then it points to German secular humanism in the 20th century, arguing that embracing Enlightenment rationalism combined with a flawed replacement theology.
The idea that the church replaced Israel.
Right. That combination, the article argues, led straight to two world wars, Nazism, the Holocaust, 6 million Jews killed, and just terrible destruction. A direct consequence in this view of choosing human reason over divine guidance.
And it doesn't stop there. It brings up Russian secular humanism, Bolshevism, communism.
That's right. Highlighting the bloody tyranny under Stalin, the gulags, maybe 60 million deaths. Then Chinese secular humanism from 1949, Mao, the Cultural Revolution, mob rule, maybe 75 million deaths.
Incredible numbers.
And finally, Cambodian secular humanism in the 70s, the Khmer Rouge, the killing fields, a third of the population lost.
These are just horrifying examples. So the article's big takeaway from all this history is
that any system, whether it calls itself religious humanism or secular humanism, if it tries to build a utopia based only on human power and wisdom without genuine submission to Christ, it's just doomed.
Doomed to what?
To tragic failure and bloody tyranny. The article concludes the harlot's man-made religious agenda, lacking that genuine consecration, is really just another flavor of humanism. It lacks real spiritual power and leads to the same kind of catastrophic results as the secular versions. It's a strong argument about consistent patterns in human power structures.
Okay, so this vision definitely takes a dark turn from the harlot's initial powerful position. While she's riding high, thinking she's ruling, the Antichrist figure is described as kind of waiting in the wings. How does that dynamic play out? What's her ultimate fate, according to the article?
Well, her effective rule is short-lived. Just that short 3.5 years, the first half of the 70th week. And during that time, she's actually put under enormous duress to persecute the saints, which echoes, you know, historical patterns. But her reign is definitely finite.
And her end isn't pretty. The article explicitly says John saw her come to an ignoble end, burned with fire, citing Revelation 18, a complete reversal. What triggers that fiery end?
It comes after a key event, the midweek abomination of desolation.
Okay, remind us what that is again?
Sure. The abomination of desolation is seen as this critical moment right in the middle of the 7 years when the Antichrist breaks his treaty, desecrates the temple in Jerusalem, and basically declares himself God.
A major turning point.
Huge. At that moment, the article says, the phase two or beast mode Antichrist will then be revealed, described as being possessed by a beast demon of the abyss. This is also when the restrainer is removed.
The restrainer, that force holding back evil.
Exactly. However you interpret that. Its removal unleashes the Antichrist's true raw power. And he begins his ultimate blaspheming 666 role for the final 3.5 years.
And this is where the Revelation 13 vision of the beast comes in, right?
Yeah.
Contrasting with the Revelation 17 picture we started with.
Precisely. Because in Revelation 13, when John sees the beast rising from the sea, critically, the harlot is no longer riding it.
She's gone from the picture.
Gone. And what's more, the 10 horns now have 10 diadems. They're crowned, which signifies, according to the article, that they have now received their own sovereign power to rule. It marks a later time period. The harlot has lost control, and these powers are now asserting their own authority.
So the very powers she rode on, the 10 horns, they turn on her. That's quite the betrayal.
It is. The article quotes Revelation 17:16, and the 10 horns which you saw, and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire.
Wow.
And it's described as God actually putting it in their hearts to do this, to fulfill his purpose. It's complete, total destruction, judgment enacted through the very powers she tried to control.
The article even throws in that Fleetwood Mac reference, Gold Dust Woman, lines like, she picks her paths and then she prays, and rulers, they make bad lovers. You better put your kingdom up for sale.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty haunting parallel.
It is, isn't it? Presented as reflecting her self-serving, manipulative approach and, well, her inevitable downfall, this fiery destruction is seen as the ultimate end of that kingdom now or kingdom of self-dominionist movement.
And it happens when?
Likely late in the second half of the 70th week, according to the article. And importantly, it highlights that call in Revelation 18:4. Come out of her, my people.
That ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues.
Exactly. Which implies there's a window, a chance for people to get out, to separate themselves from her influence before that final judgment falls.
Ew. What an intense journey through this really detailed interpretation from Dr. Gavin Finley. We've looked at John's vision, the harlot on the beast, understood the article's specific timeline, her reign in the first half of the 70th week, and explored this identity given to her, a compromised religious system tangled up with global power.
And we looked at those stark historical parallels the article draws with secular humanism's failures, the French Revolution, communism, Nazism, arguing that the harlot's religious humanism is basically destined for the same tragic end, rejected and destroyed by the very powers she courted.
Yeah, this deep dive certainly lays out a dramatic, very specific narrative. It paints a picture of religious and political powers colliding destructively against this backdrop of unfolding prophecy. It definitely challenges you to think about authority, compromise, and faith in the face of potential global upheaval.
What's really striking, I think, is that meticulous mapping of these distinct phases of power the author derives from the texts, and the underlying idea that this is all part of some predetermined divine plan. It does raise a compelling question, maybe for you to think about. If, as this article strongly suggests, even religious movements with maybe good intentions can fall into this trap of human-centered power, this religious humanism, well, what kind of vigilance is needed, maybe even today, to tell the difference between genuine spiritual guidance and something else, something seeking earthly dominion?
That is a truly thought-provoking question to leave you with. We hope this deep dive has given you a clearer, maybe more nuanced understanding of this particular and very specific perspective.